Hello, all my lovelies. Sorry I didn't post last weekend. It was my birthday and I was sick. But with all the extra content I've been posting, I hope it wasn't too sad for you. And I'm hoping you're enjoying my links to beauty in the world in the episode show notes. These things are just little items out there I wish everyone would know about. They kind of reaffirm my belief that this world is a gorgeous place. Even though the world is full of stress and heartbreak, I want to provide these little touchstones that you can visit anytime so that you can go back to remembering why this world is a very worthy place and a place filled with beauty. George Washington Carver said, "Education is the key that unlocks the golden door to freedom." And that applies to my guest this week, Guy Morris, who shares two stories of magic in his life, two miracles that changed him forever. Of course, as you'll already guess, one is about going to school, but the other one, I'll let him reveal. Suffice it to say, this lovely human is the epitome of hope and resilience. But honestly, the more I'm interviewing people, it seems like resilience is something that most of us have needed to use, which says a lot about the trauma in the world, but speaks volumes for those of us who are out here surviving and making the world a better place, even still. Please remember to rate and review the podcast, and please click on subscribe or follow to never miss an episode. And remember to share the heck out of it, please. It helps so very much. So now, my very sweet interview with Guy Morris.
Now, remind you, 10 years before this, I was sleeping under overpasses. I was getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning so I can go stand in line to work with the migrant workers in the ranches of California. I was stealing food and clothes because I couldn't buy them. So within 10 years, I had gone from completely hopeless to, my gosh, maybe anything is possible.
You know, if you had to go to a party or a conference, somewhere where you had to introduce yourself and kind of tell the world who you are, how do you self-describe?
Well, if it's at a party, now you have to understand that I tend to cover up a lot of social insecurities by being glib and a little bit sarcastic and sometimes a little bit off center. But if I were to introduce myself, I tell everybody that I'm a 38-year professional nerd that turned author. And what I mean by that is I've spent my entire career in Fortune 500 companies working for CXOs and VPs with a well-earned, often irritating reputation for reinventing and innovating and going into organizations and saying, oh, no, you guys are doing it all wrong. Let me fix it for you. Doesn't make me the best of friends at times, but I tended to be really good at it and was able to pull a lot of people along with me. And I have a lot of friends from my professional career. But I started innovating even in college. And I did so by, I was earning multiple degrees. I had to create a macroeconomic forecast model. But I really, 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 really wanted to go to grad school, but I didn't have the money. And so I made a deal with the dean of the college that if I could get my model to outperform everybody else in the school, I wanted him to put me on the list for scholarship. Well, he agreed. And so I worked like a unhinged demon to try and get my model to be the best. And I had a theory. I wanted to innovate. I thought that the models were missing something big. But nobody had ever done this. I wasn't sure that I could do it. I wanted to be able to tie. I had a theory that the reason why most of the models were missing the mark, and this was back in the late 70s at the time, was because they were not accounting for the productivity change of technology. They were only counting the dollar value of the technology sold or the services sold to implement it. So I was a geek from, and that was just the beginning. I hadn't even left college when I started doing that. So that was, so I tell everybody I'm a professional nerd who's now an author.
I'm so curious, when you were a kid, did you kind of, what were your plans for your life? Like, what did you envision or what did you want to be?
Oh, wow. My childhood is sort of I had no idea what I was going to be as a child. At one point when I was a preteen, I thought I wanted to be a musician. You know, the Beatles had come out and Paul and Simon and Garfunkel were out. And there were so many amazing groups out in Buffalo, Springfield, Crosby, Stills and Nash. I could go on. I thought that was what I was going to be, in part because I don't talk about this too often, but I was a homeless runaway at age 13. The home life I had gone to, by the time I dropped out of school with a GED in the 10th grade, I missed most of the 9th grade because I was homeless. I was on the street. And I had already gone to 16 schools at that point. And so my whole life was, what's your name? Just call me New Kid, because by the time I'm gone, you won't remember anyway. And so I really had, my ambition in life was just to survive for a long time. I left home for good when I was 15, never went back again. That was it. So I've been pretty much supporting myself since I was a young teenager. And so childhood was really, gee, I don't know what I want to be, because I was just worried about how I was going to get through the day, through the week, whatever. When I went to college, which was an amazing experience to begin with that I never expected and never planned, I was like a dry sponge. I wanted to soak. Once I got over the fear, not the fear. Absolute bone-chilling terror of learning and failing, of failure. I started realizing that, started building study school, study habits and skills and tools. I loved it. I couldn't get enough. I wound up with multiple degrees because I couldn't decide what I wanted to study. I wanted to study it all. I was just enthralled with the process. So it took a while for me to make that transition.
I was going to say, you know, you are telling your story of kind of being a teenager and being homeless and being a runaway and really in just in this place of survival, which doesn't leave a lot of room for much else. It's kind
of
like
a lot of room for dreams.
No. It's like, how do I get food? How do I find a safe place to sleep? All of this stuff. Mm-hmm. Envisioning even going to college seems like this out of reach dream. How did you even make that a possibility?
Well, you asked earlier about a miracle. And it's one of the few times that I believe that that was one of the few miracles that kind of started. I had, because I was young and idiotic and had no idea what I was doing, I wound up getting married very early, like 19. And I was, at the time, driving produce trucks. In other words, these really big, giant trucks to deliver from a warehouse to deliver produce to hospitals and hotels and restaurants and things like that. You know, 5 crates of lettuce and 4 crates of tomatoes and, you know, that kind of stuff. Really heavy stuff. And I'm not a really big man. But I was working 12, 14-hour days, 6 days a week. And I was exhausted all the time. And at one point in time, we were going to a church in Tucson, Arizona, my wife and I, my wife was already pregnant. I already was a father. So I was trying to decide I needed to do something better than the truck driving to make a living, where I could have a little bit of energy when I got home. And so we actually went to prayer that day. And in the prayer, and I'm simply asking, Lord, is it okay? You know, the church is telling me I'm not allowed to send my wife to work because I'm supposed to provide for the family, which is cool. But can I send her to work just for a couple of months so I can go have take enough time off where I can actually go look for another job? Because you can't go find another job when you're working 14 hours a day, 6 days a week. It's sort of a, you know, once the good news is you got the job, the bad news is it's the last job you'll ever have. So we went to prayer. And I kid you not, I'm in prayer, and I it's one of the maybe three times in my entire life I felt like I received a word from the Lord, which is not something I say very lightly, because I think a lot of people who do are oftentimes reading their own thoughts into what they're hearing. Well, this was definitely not something that I'd ever thought of. I want you to go. I'm not worried about your work. I want you to go to college. And I'm like, what? I said, I didn't even finish high school. I said, I never took an SAT test. I said, God, you got to get with the program here. You're obviously not talking to somebody else. I must have gotten the mixed channel. So I just ignore it. I'm praying some more. And I just get this really, really strong impression. I want you to get up right now, go to the phone, call the university and ask for an application. You are going to go to college. And I get up. And I go to do what I'm, and I thought, okay, well, this must be one of those weird test things. You know, I'm supposed to be tested for my faith, right? That's what they were teaching us. And okay, well, this, it's never going to happen, but it's going to go through the motions. I'm sure that this has something to do with me learning something. I don't know what. I get up, I go to the phone, and my wife says, what are you doing? And I tell her, and she starts laughing. And now, anybody who knew me knew that I was a smart aleck. My mother had a wicked tongue that could make a sailor cry, but I wasn't very smart. I couldn't read. I had to get other people to help me read. I was functionally illiterate. And I told her what I felt, and she laughed. She said, and I said, I know. I said, it's ridiculous. This is never going to happen. It's like the Lord's taking, you know, saying, hey, look at that monkey here. Let's send the monkey to college. And so I did. And I had to get my wife's help to complete the application. And that's how functionally illiterate I was. And so I had to pick a major. Oh, electrical engineering. What does that guy do? What does that do? You know, it's one of the hardest majors in the world. And I hadn't taken any SAT scores. So I thought, well, I'm not going to have any SATs to give in. I said, this is just an exercise in me. I don't know what's going on. Well, I go through the motions. I'm not telling a soul other than my wife what I'm doing, because I'm embarrassed by the fact that I was doing something so ludicrously insane, because there was no way I was qualified for college. And it's, oh, by the way, at this point, it's now early August. College starts in a month. It's like a month, 6 weeks away. I said, there's no way. I said, you know, they're already full, their rosters. I said, I really have no idea what I was doing it, but I did it anyway. And lo and behold, I got accepted. I was 28 units short of the minimum requirements to get in. They were going to waive that and let me make those units up as I went. And my first thought was, holy cow. I thought college was for smart people. They'll let any idiot in. I said, there's no way they should have let me in. I said, what is good? I said, this must be one of those really bad colleges. It was a state school. So I threw the letter away. The very next day, now, mind you, I hadn't said anything. My ex-wife hadn't said anything to anybody. I got an email, or not an email, it was long before email. I got a letter from my father-in-law. He was very concerned that I was going to be able to provide his daughter with a level of income and support that she deserved. He thought that I had gotten a raw deal as a child, given my upbringing. But he said that you have to work for what you want in life. And he said, if you're willing to do, you will have to have a job. But if you're willing to go to school part time or you go to school, I will help pay for your tuition and books. You'll still have to pay for your rent and your food and stuff like that. But I'd be willing to help you pay for your tuition and books, which at the time was, you know, not that much. It was a state school, but it was certainly affordable. It wasn't like going to Ivy League or anything like that, but it was way more than I had. And I thought, wow, this is the universe telling me they wanted me to make a change. And I said yes. So I went to the trash. I actually had, went to the dumpster that we'd already taken the trash out. I went to the dumpster. I found our bag. I did the dumpster dive. I had to pull out the letter. And 2 weeks later, I was in college, absolutely bone-chilling terrified that I didn't belong. I wasn't as smart as these other kids. They all seemed to know what they were doing. I had no idea. They seemed to understand the lesson plan. It was my first time getting a lesson plan. I was absolutely unprepared, absolutely terrified to my bones, but I felt that this was what I was supposed to do. And this was my chance to change my stars. And that began my transition.
That's incredible. I love really how it was just one thing after the next just happened to facilitate you, to make sure that you started off on this journey into higher education. I just really love that and so appreciate it. And also the compassion of your father-in-law, that really touches me, you know, to support you in that way.
I was blown away. No one had ever supported me in anything in my life. And to have somebody come in that didn't really know me that well, offer to provide me with such a gift. Now, all of his daughters had gone to Ivy League schools. He was a very wealthy man. He was not very wealthy, not Elon Musk wealthy, but he was pretty wealthy for the time. And I felt out of place in the family. Most of the other sisters, my wife's sisters, thought I was a gold digger. But it was a chance to change my stars. And I knew that it was that kind of chance doesn't come more than once in a lifetime. And that you take it by the horns, you don't let go, you suffer whatever you have to suffer, you put through whatever you have to put through. And I did. I worked tirelessly. I worked at nights. I went to school during the days. I took 22 to 24 units each semester. I was constantly, I think I got about 4 hours sleep on average a night for about 5 years. I wound up getting super sick toward the end because I wore myself down, but I graduated with multiple degrees. I was on the top of the dean's list. I got a full grad school scholarship. I was accepted to the Harvard MBA program. I couldn't afford Harvard, but to get accepted into their MBA program was an achievement. I got a presidential accommodation because the Federal Reserve basically changed how they were going to create their own models. I got a job at IBM. It was the beginning of a complete radical transformation in my life.
That's putting it mildly.
Yeah. Now, remind you, 10 years before this, I was sleeping under overpasses. I was getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning so I can go stand in line to work with the migrant workers in the ranches of California. I was stealing food and clothes because I couldn't buy them. So within 10 years, I had gone from completely hopeless to, my gosh, maybe anything is possible. And just having that transformation in your own mind and in your own heart was, it's scary. It's scarier than you might think to go through that kind of transformation because you never quite leave behind that sense of that I grew up with, and I was told constantly growing up, which I was worthless, to trying to find value in myself. But I'm so grateful. It turned out that I did really well. I was told my whole life that childhood I was stupid. It turned out that maybe not so much. So after rewriting the textbook on how to build a macroeconomic model, I went on to 38 years of global energy and high tech with IBM and Burroughs and Occidental Petroleum and Oracle and Microsoft and startups. And I wound up writing songs for Disney. I earned a Coast Guard charter captain's license. I produced and created award-winning webisode series. I started trying to say anything is possible. I want to do everything. I want it to be like the men of the Renaissance. They weren't just artists. They were artists, they were scientists, they were architects. They understood politics and religion. They wanted to, the idea of being a Renaissance man was being a man who basically encompassed all of the knowledge of the world. And there was a part of me that wanted to be a modern Renaissance man. And it was transformative, to say the least.
And I think it's a really powerful reminder that, you know, as we're going around in our daily lives and we see people who are homeless or don't have homes, who are struggling, that, you know, I think the tendency is to just assume that they're lazy, that they don't want to work, that they don't want to contribute. But I mean, listening to your story, those assumptions should be thrown out the window. I mean, it's
absolutely.
Yeah.
These are people who never had the opportunity or were beaten down by the circumstances of their life that they gave up. And it wasn't, and not that any of us wouldn't have given up as well. That actually made it, that actually never left me. And so one of the more difficult things I had to deal with in, as I advanced in the organizations, and I got, because I was pretty sharp and I was pretty innovative and I was, nothing was too hard to work for me. I would work 10 times harder than anybody else because I felt like I was still, even in my career, I felt like I still had to make up for the fact that I didn't grow up in a great home and get all of this breeding and leadership training by being the captain of the sports team and having a father who taught me all those leadership skills. My father left when I was 5. I didn't see him. I hadn't seen him at that point. I was constantly trying to overcompensate by working twice as hard as anybody else and taking on any risk that they would give, even though other smart guys would basically say no to that job. I'd say, I'll try, I can do it. And then taking on the impossible. But I never felt like I could drink the Kool-Aid of the sense of entitlement, the sense of privilege, the sense of we're superior. God made a superior group of people to rule the world so that the other people didn't have to. I never could get that. Oh, they're just laborers. I never could get that corporate mentality. I never fit in. I never could drink the Kool-Aid. I was always, oftentimes, even though I worked with executives, oftentimes, and if I were to have a party at my house, it might include the secretaries, it might include the janitor, it might include the maintenance guy, it might include the accountant that nobody even knew in the building. It would oftentimes be those people that I would tend to identify with more easily than my peers.
My second question always is, even though I've asked you several other questions, but did you grow up in a religious household? And I know.
Absolutely not.
No.
My mom hated God, hated religion. I spent more times on Sundays in bars than I spent in church. She was an alcoholic, married 8 times. So we were constantly in between one of her boyfriends or husbands or whatever they were. And there was only one. There was an ethnic Italian. He grew up in Newark, New Jersey, in an ethnic row house, from Sicily. His other members of the family were, I'm sure now looking back, part of the mob. And we were, when we moved from Honolulu to New Jersey, huge transition on every level. I went from surfing and snorkeling to, you know, give me your money, flip-flops kind of lifestyle. But I had to go because of his family was Catholic, even though they were non-practicing Catholics in every sense of the word. They were profane. They were criminal. They were violent. Because I wasn't confirmed as a Catholic, we were the heathen kids. And so I had to go to catechism. I was kicked out of catechism because one of the other thugs in the neighborhood he was my bully. He was my one of my bullies. And I finally, in catechism, he sat behind me and then poured a cold drink down my back. That was one of the points where I snapped. I just said enough isn't, and I was being my home life, I was being beat every day. And so it all just added up and added up and added up. And we wound up getting into a fight. I won't go into the details. I wound up getting kicked out of catechism. So that didn't go well for the Italian family. But other than that, we were not religious at all. I wound up coming to the Lord while I was a street kid. I had gone home. My stepfather had left, so I had gone home briefly to finish to get a GED. And it was while I was trying to get a GED that I'd gotten picked on. We were in Chino, California, which at the time was a very Hispanic gang area. It was not too far from a local prison, so there were a lot of Hispanic gangs. I got one of them decided to pick on me one day, and because I had already gotten past my snapping point, I got into another fight. Didn't start it, but I got into it, and I was suspended. So I was actually on. I was suspended. I was on. I had blood all over my shirt. I was walking home. My mom had already told me I was going to have the crap beat out of me when she got home. And a guy that I knew from the school, I didn't know him, but I recognized him. He had graduated, but he was one of the Jesus freaks, hippie guy with a big torn up Bible, saw me, went behind me, crossed the road, and came up behind me. Well, growing up in the streets, I just, not cool. That was not something you did. So as he approached me, I turned around, I grabbed his shirt, and I started to punch him. And he just simply lowered his eyes, put his hand on my shoulder gently, and started praying. And then he started praying in tongues. I'd never heard that. And so that was how through that experience that I actually came to the Lord. Now, when I went home and told my mom what had happened, she hauled off and just slapped me hard because she thought, you're not getting out of trouble that easy. Don't pull that religious crap on me. You know, I know all about the false religions, you know, so you're not going to pull that, you know, so you're in deep doo-doo, buddy. So that didn't go over well. That didn't produce the, oh, my son is saved results that I might have expected. But it did start another transformation in me. Now, to remind you, this is a couple of years before I went to college, and this is how I actually got to that point. But no, we did not grow up with religion at all. We were very the polar opposite.
Also, like, you're a great speaker too. I mean,
you're
a great speaker, which is not inherent in some people. You know, it's not natural for some people. So clearly,
when I was in college,
yeah.
Now, by that point, after 16 schools, my dad was from New Orleans, so for a long time I was a Southern boy from New Orleans, and all my family's from New Orleans, and all my family's from the South, and we just talk like that because my daddy talked like that, and then we moved to New Jersey. Well, you know, I got to talk like this in New Jersey, you know, because you talk like South of New Jersey, and they're gonna want to punch you because you don't use your flip flops, and then you start saying aloha and anything like that, and it's like, well, you might as well be dead meat, you know, they're gonna hook you up, buddy. And then when I got to California, they said, oh, you're from New Jersey, aren't you? It's like, well, I didn't want to be from New Jersey, so I had to relearn. So as I went to college, I would, for 15, 20 minutes before I would go to bed, I would stand in front of the mirror and I would listen to all of my affectations compared to all of these well-articulated kids who had gone to school and were raised in good homes. And I would say, we say wash, not wash. Wash. There is no R in wash. It's not wash, it's wash. And I practiced how to speak because I was so saturated with the slang and the text and the dialect and the affectations of the different places I had lived, that I felt that it made me sound dumber than I wanted to sound. And so in order to get past that, in order to be able to present to class, in order to be able to interview, when I finally got to interviews, I knew that I had to learn how to talk differently. And I still talk way too fast, but I've finally learned how to speak articulately. And that was even early years of my career, it was a problem, but I kept working on it.
Yeah, I was going to say there, it's a little different between Honolulu and Nolens. There's a little bit of a difference there.
And Newark. And yeah.
Oh, gosh. Oh, my gosh.
I was a little bit of a, you know, sometimes I would be, sometimes I would say talk Southern, sometimes I'd be talking Jersey toss, trash talk, and sometimes I'd be, you know, cool dude, you know, rat, you know, and I was a California beach kid. It was, I was all over the place. So by the time I went to college, I had no idea how to talk. No idea.
I would love to just start the portion of the program where I ask you to tell me any stories of if you've experienced or witnessed something you thought was magical or miraculous. You've shared something already, but I'd love to hear whatever else you'd like to share, whatever stories you feel are appropriate.
You know, I think just the fact that I survived so many things was miraculous. Now, it wasn't always easy. I will confess that because I didn't know it at the time. No one could diagnose it at the time. No one could tell me at the time. But I carried with me a lot of the trauma that I had as a child. And I wasn't diagnosed until I was 50, in my 50s, that I had complex PTSD. So as a result, I had a lot of addictions. I had the chronic depression, hyper anxiety, social disorders. I really didn't feel like I could fit in. I would go to executive social gatherings and I would feel like I would just basically sit in a corner because I really didn't know how to interact with people. And I think one of the miracles, if I were to call it a miracle, I would be my second wife. My first marriage was a disaster. Absolutely unmitigated disaster on every level. And after my divorce, I was a single parent for 10 years. I got custody of my son, not my daughter, which broke my heart. So I had decided that I was good at a lot of things, but picking women was not one of them. So I decided that I would only pick what one of my friends called the throwaways. You know, you're going to date them 3 or 4 times and then you're going to move on. And so I was just assuming that that would be my life. I thought I would kind of be the 7 days, 7 nights. It was a movie with Harrison Ford and Annie Hetch. And I envisioned my latter part of my life being Harrison Ford in that movie, basically a drunk bums on an island doing something dumb because he had basically given up on life and everybody had given up on him. But she came along and... At the time, I was actually leading worship at a church, and that's how I met her. And I was living on a boat with my son. I had after my divorce, we lived in a condo for a while, and I had to get roommates to afford that. And he went to live with my ex-wife for a while. And so I thought, well, what do I want to do? I don't really need this condo. And so I loved to sail, but I couldn't afford a apartment or a condo and a boat. So if I had to choose, I chose the boat. It was a really nice boat. It was 50 foot overall, beautiful boat. And so I would take people out sailing all the time. So I happened to invite my wife, my new wife, thinking that she would bring one of her boyfriends or something. Well, she came with a girlfriend, and it turned out that that day they were the only two people on the boat. So I started dating. We started dating. And after a couple of weeks, I thought, my gosh, this woman is absolutely amazing. She's way too good for me. She doesn't know that yet. The only honest thing you can do, Morris, is tell her. So I told her, okay, I'm deep in debt. I'm still paying off my first marriage. I've got all these addiction issues. I've been to therapy. They don't know what to do with me. I've got a son. Yeah, he's a lot of trouble. He's a piece of work himself. I'm going to live on a boat. By the way, I'm hoping to live my life on an island someday. So don't get too attached. You know, you're a really amazing, wonderful, terrific woman. I couldn't think of anybody better. You deserve somebody way better than me. She took that as a challenge. So 3 months later, we're on a bike ride. And I lived in the marinas. So in California, there's like a 30 mile long bike path along the beach from Palos Verdes up down to up to Malibu. And we were on the bike path, and along the way, they have like three different places. They have like these little cafes, little beach cafes, and you can go in and you can get a burger, or a hot dog, or some tea or a beer, and you can sit out. And so we thought, well, let's just rest a little bit. Let's cool down. We'll get a couple of iced teas and we'll do some people watching. She leans over to me. She says, "So when I ask you to marry me, are you going to know what you're going to say?" I had just taken a sip of my tea. I choked so hard. I was coughing. I couldn't catch my breath. I was pounding my chest. I know nothing stuck there, so I don't need a Heimlich. But I was like, I was so caught off guard. Everybody in this little cafe had turned to look at me because I was making such a scene. The guy behind me leans back and he says, "Smooth, dude." My wife, her name is Darcy, gracious as she is, she said, "That's okay. You don't need to know now. I just want you to start thinking about it." So I would consider my wife, Darcy, she's an angel. Everybody, I mean everybody, loves my wife. And that's why I still have friends. And so I consider her to be the second miracle in my life. Because I wasn't planning on it. I wasn't looking for it. I was definitely even trying to push it away. But she won me over and seduced me in a way. And it was another big major change in my life. I had grown to accept that I wasn't dumb. I had grown to accept that I had brains. My career was going really well. My social life was a total mess. And that was the fix I needed to know that someone could love me just the way I was and would be patient with me as I worked out my issues. And I had never experienced that. That was the second miracle in my life.
Hope you all enjoyed this really lovely episode and my interview with Guy. I really appreciated his story about his father-in-law and how his father-in-law had his back. Sometimes it only takes us looking for the need. Where is the need in your community, in your group of friends? And it can be as simple as taking someone out for a coffee or loaning someone $20 for gas. But his father-in-law saw the need, and he helped Guy reach the point where he is today. And we need those little angels in our lives, quite honestly. But I also really love the story about Guy finding love later in life and how that's changed him and how he recognizes that it's changed him and changed his life forever. I have a gorgeous poem I'd like to share with you from The Prophet by Khalil Gibran. "Love gives not but itself and takes not but from itself. Love possesses not, nor would it be possessed. For love is sufficient unto love. When you love, you should not say, 'God is in my heart,' but rather, 'I am in the heart of God.'" And what a gorgeous thought for all of us to remember, that we are all in the heart of God, always. Whatever that God looks like, even if you're an atheist, you are a part of this world, and you are precious, and you are held and cherished within it. I need to thank Guy for his incredible interview and for sharing his stories. And I'd like to thank all my listeners. And please remember, ratings and reviews and sharing the podcast, I absolutely thank you from the bottom of my heart. Thank you for listening. And here's my one request. Be like Guy. Be resilient. And be complex. And be who you want to be, as long as you're not hurting other people. This world loves interesting and gorgeous human beings who are fulfilling their goals, their lives, bringing more beauty in this world. And so I urge each of you to be like Guy, not give up hope, and keep striving for bringing more beauty into the world. See you next week for the next episode of The Pod. And until then, I hope your world is full of generosity, love, and grace where you least expect it.